Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. I'm Deputy Tech Editor Daniela Cheslow in for Stephen Overly while he's on vacation. It's Friday, March 29th. The heads of the biggest tech firms in the U.S. and the world tend to be male, and it's been that way since the dawn of the industry. But women have played a critical role in developing computers, going back to the first computer, which existed only in the imagination 200 years ago. Claire Evans traces that history in her book, Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. And in honor of Women's History Month this March, I called Claire up to talk about her book and the women she turns to today for navigating the rising profile of AI. Here's our conversation. Hi, Claire. Welcome to Politico Tech.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. When we talk about computers today, we're talking about keyboards and screens. But you write that the earliest computers were women. Their work was even measured in girl hours or kilo girls. What was the daily life of a computer like?
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, you're right. The very first usage of the word computer was to refer to human computers. In fact, it was placed in print in a classified ad in the New York Times that was looking to hire a computer, not buy one. Because, yeah, before computing machines were invented, somebody had to do the math. The early scientific age required an enormous amount of calculation, and that calculation was done by hand. And we're talking about problems related to maritime navigation, astronomy, and ballistics. And in order to tackle those complex computations, people, almost always women because they were cheaper to hire, so you get more people to do the same job, would sit down at long tables and work on little pieces of larger problems. So they wouldn't tackle the entire problem on their own. They would break them down into smaller segments and process them in a parallel way, if you will, in these sort of distributed networks. And sometimes that would happen in a kind of almost factory-like context. Sometimes that work was done from home, from mathematical instructions that were sent in the mail. So computing was also the original cottage industry as well.
It sounds like mathematical piecework.
Exactly, yes.
Well, let's go into some of the key figures you mention in your book. A very early pioneer you write about was Ada Lovelace. She was born in 1815, right? That's well before the first computer, and yet she's known as the first programmer. Tell me about Ada and the machine she programmed.
Yeah, exactly. She died a century before the invention of computers as we know them, but she's considered to be the very first computer programmer. She's a super interesting character, both sort of historically and kind of on a literary level, because she was the product of a brief, tumultuous liaison between the romantic poet Lord Byron and a British aristocrat named Annabella Milbank. And that relationship must have ended very badly, because Annabella tried to erase Byron's influence from her daughter by starting her on a rigorous mathematics education when she was four.
So her mathematical prowess was a product of throwing away poetry?
Exactly. But you can't throw away poetry and a poetic soul, because she really maintained that romantic spirit. It's part of like what made her so brilliant, because, yeah, she was a woman in the early 19th century. So obviously she was unable to formally access a higher education, but she was an aristocrat and she had this very unique situation with her mother. So she benefited from a lifelong tutelage with all these, you know, brilliant mathematicians and scientists of her day. But yeah, she was also Lord Byron's daughter. So she had this sort of poetic sensibility. And that meant that by the time she was old enough, she was maybe one of the only people who was poised to really understand the cultural and economic significance of this machine called the analytical engine, which was a very early computing machine that was designed by a mathematician named Charles Babbage, who was kind of her contemporary in British society. And it was so complex and expensive and required like so many different precisely milled parts that it was never actually fully built. The British government that funded it kind of bailed on the project after a decade because it was way, way ahead of its time. But working from the plans, Ada, in her spare time, as she was running two estates and being a woman in society at the time, she was able to outline a number of different mathematical proofs that would later be recognized by hardware engineers in the 1950s as being the first algorithms. So yeah, but I think, but more importantly than being the first at anything, because I think firsts always invite contention, she had this conceptual foresight that was really important. She was able to envision a future in which computing machines would be able to operate not only on numbers, which the different analytical engine was intended to do, but also on anything it was possible to symbolically represent. So she wrote about computers that could process logic, patterns, music. So that really sets the stage for what computers would ultimately become, right? These sort of do-everything devices, not just big calculators.
If we talk about Ada and the machine she programmed, tell me about this machine and what was her role in it?
The machine was called the Analytical Engine, and it was so outrageously ahead of its time that it could never even be built in Victorian England. It was really, when I say machine, I mean machine. If you look at, you know, what's left of early sort of constructions of the Analytical Engine's components that are in museums, it looks like part of a steam engine or something. It's this huge, hulking, mechanical thing that was designed to calculate tables of equations. And Ada was able to look at that thing, that big, hulking calculator, and imagine a future in which a machine like that could operate on a higher symbolic level, could process logic, patterns, symbols, and music. So she was really a pioneer sort of conceptually in terms of understanding what computers would represent.
Let's move ahead a little bit. You write about how some of the first computers were put to use in World War II. They were huge and nobody knew how to run them, and the military was operating them 24 hours a day. And one of the people running those without a manual was Grace Hopper. Let's hear about her.
Okay. Grace Hopper was a mathematician. She was one of the first women to receive a PhD in mathematics from Yale. And when the Second World War broke out, she enlisted in the Navy, even though she was like almost 40, because she wanted to apply her mathematical skills to maybe like cryptography or something that she thought would be relevant to the war effort. But the day she graduated from midshipman school, they deployed her to a basement lab at Harvard, where she came face to face with this 8-foot-tall, 10,000-pound mechanical computer called the Mark I, which was actually inspired by Charles Babbage's designs for the analytical engine a century earlier.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all connected. But she had zero engineering background. I mean, she's a genius, but she didn't know engineering. And there was no operating manual for this thing, as would be the case for all these early computers, because, you know, it's the first of its kind. So she was tasked with putting a program on it. And that was not obvious. Fortunately, she was a born autodidact, so she just stayed up late, slept at her desk, and studied engineering blueprints and circuit diagrams and figured it out. And by the end of the war, she was running the entire lab. In fact, she ended up writing the manual for the Mark I.
What was the Mark I doing?
It was doing, like, oceanography, minesweeping, ballistics problems was really the main usage of computers during the Second World War. So during the war, the primary sort of computational requirements of the war was that the boys on the front needed what were called firing tables, which were essentially just charts that would tell you exactly at what angle and what velocity to shoot, you know, missiles at the enemy. And those tables require an enormous amount of calculation because you've got to consider wind speed, distance, velocity, all this stuff. The calculations were originally done at the early part of the war by, guess what, human computers working, again, 24 hours a day cranking out these tables. It became unsustainable, so the original computing machines were designed to do that automatically. And the first people that ran those machines were, of course, the women that were already doing that math.
So I'm imagining people firing some kind of tank or cannon, and they're looking at a paper printout of where all, you know, all of what they need to know.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? It's like consulting a dictionary to play Angry Birds or something.
Let's skip forward a few decades and go to the Bay Area as the internet was coming into existence. I want to hear about Elizabeth Jake Feinler, who played a key role in this time. You've described her as a one-woman Google. What was her role and what years are we talking about?
This is the 70s, so we've skipped forward quite a bit. Computers jumped out of the basement of the war theater, became, you know, known and public entities. The early computing industry was underway. And the problem of how to distribute massive computing resources to researchers, academics, and people in the military across the country was becoming sort of the main concern of computer science. And so the early internet was known as the ARPANET. It was set up by the military, and it connected different computers at different sites across the country into one network. That network started small, but it got really big really quickly. One of the main flaws with the early ARPANET is that there was no central like database or search engine that would allow you to figure out what was available where at what different sites. The only sort of resource there was an office at Stanford called the Network Information Center that was run by an information scientist, a librarian named Elizabeth Feinler. She went by Jake Feinler. And she was, for 20 years, really, the one-woman Google of her day. She wrote the original white pages and yellow pages for the ARPANET.
Wait, sorry, what? There were white pages and yellow pages for the ARPANET?
I mean, that's kind of a euphemistic way of describing it. But yeah, she published the documents that sort of collated what all the resources were at all the different sites and who was on that network, you know, who would actually be responsible for maintaining all the different sites. So the sort of, I think it's easier to call them the white pages and the yellow pages. She also wrote the sort of original technical specifications for the ARPANET. And basically, if you had a question about how the ARPANET worked or what resources were where, you would call a phone number. You would call the Network Information Center phone number, and she's the person that would answer the phone. She was the one that would tell you where everything was. So it's kind of amazing to think about now a time in which the internet was small enough that one person could actually answer those questions. I mean, obviously the office grew and grew and grew, and it was staffed by a lot of other female librarians who, like many female workers, their jobs weren't taken super seriously. They were considered to be sort of secretarial in nature. But in an information age, the people who manage that information become very important. So I think she's a really under-recognized and central figure in the early internet.
We'll be right back. When you pull back and you look at people like Jake Feindler, Grace Hopper, Ada Lovelace, and others, what is the pattern you see about the way women fit into what was and remains a male-centric industry?
Yeah, I mean, basically, this might sound a little bit reductive, but if you're looking for women in the history of technology, look first at the beginnings of things. And I say that because, yes, of course, women are pioneers, but also at the beginnings of a field or the beginnings of an industry, that's the moment in which there isn't a lot of pre-established institution or power structure to contend with. It's more of an open playing field. And a lot of times in this history, women are taking on these jobs at key early points in the development of the technology, jobs which are not necessarily considered to be very important. If you look at programming, you know, the women like Grace Hopper who were working on these early computers, they were called operators or coders. The association was maybe more like a telephone operator than an engineer. I mean, those jobs are actually technically classified as sub-professional. They weren't considered to be important jobs. And that's why women were given those jobs. Same with our human computers, right? They were doing this math that wasn't considered to be super important either. And that is a pattern that repeats itself, except the problem is that, you know, those jobs do turn out to be important, especially when people put a lot of energy into refining and developing them. The early programmers went from just patching cables to thinking about how to make the process of programming faster and more efficient. So in the process, they invented, you know, workflows and compilers and eventually programming languages, which would make that process better, faster, and more efficient. And that's when programming became important, became something that was considered to have value that was separate from just flipping switches and patching cables. And that's when we start seeing women be pushed out of the industry that they helped to invent. And that has happened again and again in the history of computing at various different key points.
If we're looking at today's tech landscape, do you see any change in that pattern, or is it mostly maintaining the same thing?
I wish I could say that things are different. I think there's a lot more attention being paid to these questions, which bodes well. And of course, there's a lot more investment in, you know, early STEM education for girls, for example. But, you know, power is going to power. And I think like the consolidation of power will always lead to the same patterns reenacting themselves. And, you know, incidentally, I don't think this is unique to tech. I give talks about this book all the time and people come up to me afterwards and say like, oh, it's so interesting. The same thing happened in medicine or in video editing. I mean, these are recurring patterns in human society. It's something that we need to contend with at a much larger scale than just, you know, within the tech industry.
Your book came out in 2018, and of course, since then, we've seen the rise of AI. There are other new developments on the tech landscape. What role are women playing in today's tech industry?
I think for me, the most inspiring and interesting and important women in the AI space aren't necessarily those building the tools. They're the people that are questioning the deployment of the tools. I think about AI ethicists like Margaret Mitchell or Temnit Gebru. Think about people who are building alternative platforms and systems like Meredith Whitaker, who's the head of the Signal Foundation. People who are thinking about questions of privacy, who are thinking about how technologies are built, trained, and set loose on the world, and really questioning and holding truth to power.
One of the articles you've written fairly recently was about tech, but from the perspective of some of its philosophical questions.
Mm-hmm.
You recently wrote, rather than competing with us for the mantle of humanity, AI agents and robots can be our collaborators, just as messenger pigeons, truffle hunting pigs, and guide dogs help us perform different tasks today. Who are the women you're turning to for navigating this new era of AI agents and robots?
Yeah, I mean, that specific idea of thinking of AI and robotics as sort of as animals rather than people is really inspired by a robot ethicist named Kate Darling at MIT, who wrote a great book called The New Breed, which basically argues that we need to stop thinking about AI as like artificial people, because that really puts us on edge and creates all this confusion and gives rise to this unnecessary moral panic about, you know, personhood. And instead of thinking of it that way, let's try a new metaphor in which we sort of frame AI agents as animals. I think that's really fascinating. I think she looks at our relationship to animals and animal rights to discuss how we could potentially broker new relationships with our technology. In general, I think that makes AI less frightening, sort of puts it in a historical context, but it also decenters the human perspective a little bit and asks us to reorient ourselves to the world. And I don't know, my sincerest hope about AI right now, although like I realize in the context of the industry as it's developing now, is maybe sounds a little bit Pollyanna-ish or something, is that if we are working to build intelligent systems, that will help us to realize that intelligence is like a really manifold thing with lots of different like shapes, and that human intelligence isn't the be-all and end-all of all this, because yeah, everything alive processes information in some way. So I think we could really look to the natural world for metaphors like Kate Darling does, but also, you know, for actual practical solutions. I think the through line for me is humility and kind of an awareness that monolithic perspectives and power don't necessarily serve the greater whole.
If you write a volume 2 of Broadband, what do you think might go in there?
Oh, man, I always joke about broader band. This time it's personal. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my book ends at the collapse of the dot-com bubble because I grew up in the 90s and I feel like I was too close to it to historicize it. So perhaps in 20 years, I'll look back at the period of time in which the web went from being this academic swap session to being this sort of central power structure of our world. And I'll have something interesting to say about it. But until then, I'm just going to live it, I think, with like everybody else.
That was historian Claire Evans. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah, and our editors are Steve Heuser, me, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. Have a great weekend, and see you back here on Monday.